From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's happening on this week's show.
The Duchess of Cambridge has been delivered of a son.
It's a son born at 4:24 p.m.
Prince William and Kate have named their newborn baby George Alexander Louis. He'll be known as His Royal Highness Prince George of Cambridge.
It's a boy! The eyes of the world were on Kensington Palace this week with much anticipation of the birth of a first child to the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. You're going to be surprised who's commenting on this. Rabbi Simcha Weinstein will be here to share some thoughts on this happy occasion.
The purpose is to restore America to our Judeo-Christian heritage and reestablish a Christian culture.
That's David Lane, an evangelical political power player that says such consistently nutty things that it's hard to believe anyone takes him seriously.
I think the process of mercy looks like probably car bombs in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. and Des Moines, Iowa.
Except that politicians eager to court the conservative Christian vote like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul actually do. So does Rick Perry, who's made sure that some of Lane's agenda got enshrined in Texas law. Now, these are men that are understood to be preparing a run for the White House, and they seem to believe the likes of Lane can help them get there. This week, we'll hear from Peter Montgomery, who's been doing some outstanding writing on this movement, and a Christian Nation event in Iowa they attended earlier this month, will be with us to try to make some sense of all of it. I know Peter, he can do that. But first,
parents that are deported are forced to leave their children behind.
This is a president whose administration has deported more people than any other president.
Last Thursday in our nation's capital, a diverse group of faith leaders and supporters marched to the White House, the culmination of a series of actions that began back in May 1st. Actions designed to spur President Obama to stop the record level of deportations his administration has been executing, and to raise awareness of the moral and justice components of this important issue. Leading the procession, as well as a faith service, and presenting a petition signed by more than 4,000 people of faith was Bishop Minerva Carcano, official spokesperson on immigration for the United Methodist Church. Bishop, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you.
Would you start by talking about who's participating in terms of faith traditions and backgrounds and how this movement came together?
Well, we've had about 100 leaders, immigrant leaders, from all across the country, Catholic, evangelical, Protestant, those who are between faith as well, mm-hmm. because of the impact of this kind of journey and because of where they find themselves in the shadows of society, not yet quite integrated. So it was a diverse group in terms of faith perspective. It was a group that represents the best leadership from among our immigrant community. Many of them were persons who are undocumented, some of them with ankle monitors, and so they're at a very precarious place in their journey, and others who have not yet been detected but were willing to come forth, even if this meant that somebody would recognize them and detain them. There is a growing coalition of those who stand with immigrants from the faith perspective, from the employment labor perspective and organizing perspective. Communities of immigrants are arising and saying enough. And the network that is being created will make a change and is making a change in this country.
Thursday was the closing of the rolling fast to call for change and how immigration policies are implemented. I'd like for you to talk about the origins of the fast on May 1st and how that worked and the tradition of nonviolent action that connects you to all of this?
Well, the fast is based on the fact that this is a movement of people of deep faith, people who know that when we fast before God, God hears our prayers. When we fast, it gives us an opportunity to put our lives into perspective. We quit paying attention to our carnal human needs in order to pay attention to something greater. And so immigrants and people who stand with them made the decision to take a break from those normal things we do to create space for reaching out to God, reaching out to others, paying attention to this critical moment in history and deciding how we're going to lead this country and our communities as well around immigration.
Has it worked for the people? I mean, do they feel empowered by this?
I saw it. I really saw it. And one of the pieces of empowerment was immigrant voices, immigrant men and women. A 13-year-old, Catherine Figueroa from Maricopa County in Arizona, a woman named Sandra, a young man from Vermont. Sandra's from Atlanta, a young man from Vermont, young adult, all of whom said to me, if you had said to me a year ago that I would be speaking in Washington, D.C., I would have said there is not a single possibility. Mm-hmm. But the fast has empowered them, has given them strength to come forth, knowing that there's a whole national community fasting and praying has given them strength.
Hmm. What specific changes are you asking for, and where does the impetus of that come from, specifically in terms of your faith?
It's a campaign around not one more. Not one more person immigrant deported, not one more family torn apart because of a deportation or a detention, and not one more person affected because they've reported a crime and therefore have been detained by immigration or questioned or harassed. And so that's been the focus, to ask the president primarily to use his administrative power to detain the deportations. We've had more deportations under President Obama than any other president that we are aware of. 12 million people, 1,200 immigrants are deported every day in this country. That's 1,200 families. That's 1,200 congregations. That's 1,200 neighborhoods and communities that are being affected. 1,200 jobs that are being affected as well. We're all affected when an immigrant is deported. So to stop that deportation, that harassment, that detention, indefinite in some case, detention of immigrants, is critical, not only for the immigrant or their immediate families. It affects all of us, mm-hmm. all of us.
Yeah. Bishop Carcano, how does the work of the legislature relate to the actions that you're demanding from the executive branch of government?
The president has certain executive administrative powers. I've been at table with President Obama. I've been at table even more so with his staff focused on immigration. And what they argue is that the president is the enforcer of the law and therefore has had a need to enforce the law. I appreciate that he is the enforcer of the law. But he also has administrative power in this circumstance to ask Homeland Security to stop the deportations while Congress makes a decision around humane, just, and I would want to add sane, sane immigration reform. One note that continues to give me hope is the fact that a year ago, the president did take an action, an executive administrative action, to side with young immigrants, mm-hmm. with the Dreamers, and to say, we're going to allow them to stay. They are the future for their families, but also for this country, and we are living in a broken immigration system. So let's be the compassionate, just-filled country that we have a history of being, mm-hmm. and let's side with them. That continues to give me hope.
You published a very moving article in Huffington Post this week headlined, Immigration, It's About Families. Talk a little more about that, if you will.
I woke up one night unable to sleep because of what I see happening around immigration reform in this country, and wrote that article out of a need to just deal with the feelings I was having. I think they're feelings that many people in this country share. And that is the way that we have forgotten that this is about families. It's not about numbers. It's about little children and young people, men and women, who are here undergirding our economy, here because we've had some impact on their own economies from the countries they come from, the impact of NAFTA and CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And I'm concerned about them. I'm concerned about the militarization of the border, $46 billion to secure a border. When those border communities, and I have now served the whole extent of the border, and I have never been in a community that wanted those walls on either side. And so $46 billion, that is sinful. That is sinful. What message do we send to the world, not just to Mexico, but to the world? What message do we give our children here, that we secure the world by a wall, that we need to separate ourselves out from other people? It's the wrong message. It's the wrong investment of incredible resources. $46 billion could transform the economic situation of North and South America if we chose to make that investment, and would do more to right this situation of immigration than anything else.
Yeah. Well, in the article you wrote, these are immigrant men and women, children and young people who not only deserve better, but whose struggle will bring judgment upon this country for decades to come if we don't begin to treat them justly.
If it were a just movement, it would be comprehensive, truly comprehensive immigration reform that would take into consideration how economic agreements in the region and globally have affected migration that comes into this country. NAFTA, one clear example, 2 million farmers were left destitute in Mexico because of the impact of NAFTA. So that kind of economic examination and correction is necessary. A pathway to citizenship for those immigrants who are already here. Those immigrants are here serving in this country. They've come here. They've contributed to the economy. They've contributed to our way of life. And they need to be recognized. If we set up a second class of citizenship, it begins to erode not only our families and our communities, but our democracy as well. The labor rights of persons need to be respected, need to be protected for any worker, be they documented or undocumented. The reunification of families. We have families where half of the family is documented and half is not. A mother, a father documented children who are not, or vice versa, and yet they're separated because of our broken immigration policy. That needs to be corrected.
So what's next in this?
We continue to pray, we continue to fast, and we continue to hold up the voice for justice. That's the role of communities of faith. As a Christian, Scripture is full of wonderful, wonderful examples of how we are to treat the immigrant. And we need to live that and not just preach that.
Bishop Minerva Carcano is the first Hispanic woman elected to the Episcopacy of the United Methodist Church. Today, she serves as Bishop of Los Angeles and is the denomination's official spokesperson on immigration. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my privilege. God bless.
Still to come on this week's show, Rabbi Simcha Weinstein on the new royal offspring in England. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. It's the dog days of summer, and politics is the furthest thing from the minds of normal Americans pretty much everywhere except inside the Beltway. But earlier this month in Iowa, Christian Nation advocate David Lane organized an event, Rediscovering God in America. And it drew the likes of Senators Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. Here to talk about why this is potentially a big deal is Peter Montgomery, a senior fellow at People for the American Way. He has just written some in-depth articles on this whole thing for rightwingwatch.org. Peter, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. I'm always happy to be here.
So I'm not sure how many people caught the quote from Ted Cruz's father, Rafael Cruz, where he referred to his son as the anointed one. It would seem Cruz and several other potential candidates for the White House are looking for the anointing of David Lane as well.
Well, David Lane has been trying really hard to make his chosen one the anointed one. Last time around, he tried very hard to do that with Rick Perry. And he was, you know, successful in generating a huge amount of coverage and enthusiasm for Perry. And until Perry sort of tanked in the debates, it looked like he might have had some real momentum. And before that, Lane was able to deliver the Iowa caucus in 2008 to Mike Huckabee. So he's really shown an ability to organize and turn out among the religious right base.
What's the appeal?
Well, he is a guy who likes to stay behind the scenes, and he's an organizer. He organizes events for pastors. He's done it, he says, for more than 10,000 pastors in 15 states, getting a bunch of conservative pastors together and then haranguing them that they need to be more involved in politics, because he says the reason the country's going to hell is that there's not enough aggressively political preaching from the right. So that's him. And I frankly think that a lot of the politicians like him because he's not one of these guys who's competing with them for the limelight. He's very happy generally to stay out of it.
What about his role in opposing Mitt Romney?
Well, he is, first and foremost, an activist for the Christian nation, thinks the country was founded by Christians for Christians, and he does not believe that Mormons qualify. And he says it's a false god that Mormons worship. And so he was cheerleading back when there was a flap about one of Rick Perry's supporters making anti-Mormon comments about Romney. And a lot of people were sort of backing off of that. And he was saying, no, this is good. We have to draw the distinction. We have to remind people that this is a false god that Mitt Romney worships. So he was really, really unhappy that Mitt Romney was the nominee. And he's going to try to make sure nothing like that happens again.
Peter, you describe David Lane and his ilk as Christian nation extremists. What is it and what's the ilk of these people?
Well, the ilk is that they believe that the nation was founded by Christians for Christians and that therefore their interpretation of the Word of God, their interpretation of the Christian Bible should be the law of the land. And they're not particularly concerned about the rights of religious minorities. And they are aggressively trying to push back on separation of church and state, which they say has turned America into a pagan nation. And David Lane says, this is the moment we have to decide if we're going to be a Christian nation or a pagan nation. And his rhetoric on that is getting increasingly warlike. And he complains that when Roe v. Wade was passed in 72, he says the church didn't make a peep when it should have been fomenting riots and revolution. That's his mindset.
So when you hear of a Christian nation type person like this, and an endorsement for a candidate from someone like this, you can pretty well be assured they trust the candidate to try and make Christianity the predominant religion, the state religion of the United States.
That's why they're pushing hard to push their candidates forward. It's partly why he works so hard to get Rick Perry as the Republican nominee, because he doesn't trust the establishment Republicans. He does not think the Republican Party is sufficiently committed to his vision. I think that people who go and embrace him should be held accountable for that. And
sure.
People like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, somebody needs to asking them if they share this guy's vision of the country.
So does the participation of prominent leaders like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul at David Lane events legitimize them, or does it just marginalize the politicians from the party?
Well, I think when you have someone like David Lane who has demonstrated his ability to, for example, help Huckabee win the Iowa caucus, mm-hmm. who played a key role in having three Iowa State Supreme Court justices voted out of office, people don't dismiss him because he has shown that he has some real ability to organize. Mm-hmm. Now, he can't do everything. He could not keep Romney from becoming the nominee last time around. But he really sees this as a war within the Republican Party, as part of the larger war for the soul of the country. And he's fighting it. He's not going away. He's got a 12-state strategy for 2013 and 2014. He's backed by a lot of money from the American Family Association, which has deep pockets and 200 radio station network. And he's connected to this other deep pockets group called United in Purpose, which is conservative evangelical money coming out of Silicon Valley. Another thing that might surprise some people, that there's a pot of money there that's hoping to do for right-wing candidates sort of what Obama's tech team did for him last time around.
We've seen some really extremist legislatures, state legislatures, pass some really questionable legislation. Is Perry, in this legislation they've been passing in Texas, the anti-abortion legislation, is he qualifying himself?
Sure. I think the wave of that kind of legislation that we've seen around the country since 2010 is the best repudiation of all the mainstream media notions that just because Obama won re-election, the religious right is doomed or dying as a political force. I mean, they elected a lot of really bad people to office, and those people have gerrymandered the legislatures, and now they're going to town. And people are going to be suffering in a lot of states because of that. And, you know, Lane is part of a much bigger movement that has a huge infrastructure.
Is Lane's fingerprints on the state legislatures that have been making these crazy decisions?
I don't know how directly they are, but certainly in a lot of those states that were the battleground states in 2010 and 2012, he was organizing conservative pastors, telling them to mobilize their congregations. He was part of this Champion the Vote effort that United in Purpose, the Silicon Valley outfit, did, which was an effort to register and turn out 5 million additional conservative evangelicals. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think in a lot of states, they certainly help elect a lot of conservatives, whether or not Obama or Romney happened to win that particular state.
You say that there is certainly a divide between Lane and the GOP, and I take it that he's proud of that because he doesn't like where the GOP is. What kind of war is he waging against the GOP?
Well, it's kind of funny because from my perspective, there's a lot less distance between him and the rest of the GOP than I would like to see. Yeah. You know, the party itself has moved so far into his direction, but a lot of it boils down to that report that the party did after Obama won re-election. And there was a lot of conversation about this sort of autopsy that they did that some social conservatives took as a sign that, you know, the Washington consultant class was saying we should tone down the social conservative rhetoric. And that was interpreted by people like David Lane as a declaration of war against them from the party. And so they've, you know, been making very clear that they're not going to go away and they are not going to let the party downplay the things that they care most about. And I recently, the most recent Ralph Reed big gathering here in Washington in the last couple of months, Reince Priebus came and made this really almost pathetic plea to the attendant to say, you know, talk about what a great Christian he was, talk about how committed he was, because he does not want to be seen as fomenting a war with this religious right base that the party counts on. But he certainly, his rhetoric, his goals certainly are at the pretty far fringe. You know, when he talked recently about saying that he wants to force Republican candidates to agree to make the Bible the principal textbook in public schools and return us to a Christian culture, or he's going to go after them, that's pretty out there.
It certainly is.
And yet he's not a loner. He's working very closely with what we think of as more establishment religious right people, you know, David Barton and Matt Staver from Liberty Council and Jim Garlow. They're all part of his network. They're all allies.
How would you profile his agenda? What are the things he talks about most wanting to change?
Well, everything that he says that he thinks is a sign of a pagan culture, one is certainly legal access to abortion. You know, he's out to criminalize abortion. the advance of LGBT equality is another thing that he sees as, you know, an abomination and against God's law. But he has also pretty much signed on to the whole agenda that a lot of right-wing strategists have tried to sort of merge the religious right with the Tea Party, you know, anti-big government rhetoric, anti-debt rhetoric. And him, for him particularly, this notion of pushing religion back into the public schools, pushing this notion of a Christian culture and reestablishing, in his words, a Christian culture. I mean, those are his motivating forces.
Points, yeah. I mean, you think about it. We're sitting here in 2013. He's working toward 2016. You wonder how could it intensify given where he started?
I think for him, of his dozen states in 2013 and 14, I don't know what he sees as sort of the most important battleground issues, people there in 2014. Mm-hmm. But you're certainly right that it's about, you know, establishing some more muscle within the party to try to do for whoever he chooses what he tried to do for Rick Perry.
Right.
He's very clear that he does not want another McCain or Romney. And Ted Cruz would like to be that man. Mm-hmm. Rand Paul would clearly like to be that man. And I'm sure there's others who would like to be that man.
Well, Peter, you and I both know that your organization, People for the American Way, has always been at the forefront of trying to oppose these Christian Nation activists. What are you all doing on this? I mean, you've got great literature now. What's PFI doing on this?
Well, a big part of what we do through Right Wing Watch, through the blog and our more in-depth reports, is to try to put a spotlight on this and call attention to it. And then we really also – we want to hold public officials accountable for making alliances with extremists that and giving them credibility they don't deserve. You know, mentioning, of course, it gives Lane credibility with these 600 pastors when he's got presidential hopefuls tromping through. It's the same reason we try to call out members of Congress when they go on Brian Fisher's radio show, because it gives credibility to his extremism. He's one of the American Family Association's big spokespeople. So that's a big part of it. And we also have increasingly invested a lot of money in youth leadership programs to help get into the pipeline from college progressives to young elected officials, to help make sure that we have people in office who have a different idea of the American way and the Constitution than David Lane does.
Yeah. Peter Montgomery is Senior Fellow at People for the American Way, a leading organization fighting for progressive values in our country. Thanks a lot for being here again. Every time you come, you bring us enlightenment that we may not like, but we need to know, and you inspire us to do something about it. Thanks.
Well, thank you. I'm always happy to be here.
A lot of time has passed now. Some people can't relate. They don't like public worship, so they misuse church and state. But don't forget Tom Jefferson. His words slice like a knife. We all owe our Creator our liberty, our life. Under God.
I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Well, maybe it wasn't quite at the level of waiting for a new pope to be elected, but much of the world was aware that a potential heir to the throne of England was due to be born last week, when the first son of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge finally arrived. It's natural that there was great celebration. Taking part in that celebration with his unique take was Rabbi Simcha Weinstein, who published an article titled "Let's Hear It for the Boy." And he's here now to talk about some of his thoughts. Simcha, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's great to be on the show, and a big mazel tov.
You make some really interesting observations about young Prince George's lineage, so let's just start right there.
Well, you know, according to some of the commentators, and I read an article a couple of years ago by the noted Macha lawyer Alan Dershowitz, there does seem to be some Jewish lineage in the Middleton family, and also in the late Princess Diana's family. Although I have noticed that the palace genealogists have been quick to dismiss this.
I see.
As a rabbi, and especially growing up in England on the other side of the pond, I mean, today I live in, in sunny Brooklyn, but I am English and I grew up in England. You know, we really grew up with tremendous respect for the royal family, and there is a tradition in Judaism of saying blessings when we are in the presence of royalty and of government. We really look to the monarchy because they are the closest thing, you know, that we come to in our day-to-day life to the ultimate King of Kings, to the Almighty. So we really have tremendous respect and affinity towards the monarchy. I mean, in England, in every prayer book, there is a prayer that we bless the Queen. We bless the Queen that she should deal favorably and justly with matters concerning the Jewish people and matters concerning the state of Israel. Uh-huh. So we really do, you know, we try to find favor in her heart because she has, you know, so much power and so much authority.
Your latest book, entitled The Case for Children, Why Parenthood Makes Your World Better. So it's only natural that you've been spending a lot of time, I guess, thinking about these issues. How do you think baby George is going to make things better for the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge?
Well, you know, we're trying to keep up with the House of Cambridge. You know, the closest thing we have in America is I guess, the Kardashians, unfortunately. So I think it really gives inspiration. I think that Kate Middleton is really a woman of her time. She's 31. The late Diana was 20 when she first had William. So she's really a woman of the time. She's more educated. She had a child later on in life, as many more women do today. I think she really mirrors the society that she's part of. I thought it was interesting that it was actually William who put the car seat in the car. He got in. He drove off there. They try to be very relatable. They're really mm-hmm. a 21st century couple, even though, you know, he did drive off himself to the palace, you know, not to the two-bedroom apartment like I have in Brooklyn. So, you know, they do have a slightly different life. But I hope that will inspire young couples to take on the awesome responsibility of parenthood. It is difficult. It's not easy. You know, when the baby cries at 4 o'clock in the morning and there's feedings and you're tired and you're stressed. But I hope that this couple will really, you know, light a spark and a flame in the hearts of couples all over the world. And that does seem to be happening. I see in England there is this baby fever. Many couples have actually held off naming their children. And now we're seeing the name George just suddenly shot up to the most popular British name at the moment.
Rabbi Weinstein, I have to ask you, did you intend to be in London when this happened?
No, I'm in Brooklyn. I did not. I was a little bit offended because apparently all of the monarchs actually are circumcised. So nobody asked me to perform the Brit Mila, the circumcision. I have a good plethora of rabbi jokes that are very apropos to circumcision, but nobody asked me. But I am excited, although I have to be honest, Welton, I did feel a little bit guilty because last week I did become a citizen of the United States of America.
Oh my gosh! Congratulations! So
I'm a little bit split in my loyalty.
Yeah. Well, you write that the royal baby might help make parenthood more fashionable. Did you write that tongue in cheek, or could there actually be some truth in that?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I think within, you know, popular culture, parenthood is never looked at as desirable or sexy. You never see, you know, James Bond suddenly stop a mission to go pick up the kids from preschool. But I really hope that this child will ignite an excitement. I think that they are a good-looking couple. They're a young couple. They seem very clearly in love, and they look very good, very happy, very content together. I really hope this will be an inspiration to many, many couples.
Simka, I thought the last few sentences of your article were really important. You write about every child being a king and the promise every birth brings.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really believe that, you know, every child is royalty and every child is a king. You know, and this little child that they brought home has no idea the magnitude of his being, and he's really an open book. And just like every child has the power, has the ability to change the world. And, you know, we look at the world, innovation is really a young man's game. So I'm hoping that, you know, we will see populations increase, and that this increased population will bring an increased blessing. It says in the Talmud that every baby is born with bread in their basket, that everyone has a blessing, everyone has something to contribute, and we shouldn't be afraid of the cost and the stress, because I ultimately really believe the benefits will outweigh them in the end.
Rabbi Simcha Weinstein is a best-selling author who's been voted New York's hippest rabbi. He chairs the Religious Affairs Committee at Pratt Institute, and his latest book is The Case for Children, Why Parenthood Makes Your World Better. Thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
God bless you. Thank you. And I enjoy our dialogues, and I look forward to our future dialogues.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to us today. Would help. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show. Hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to radio stations near you. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week. Use Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. We encourage you to tell others about this show and encourage them to listen. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a